Welcome to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. I'm Russ White. At 6 past the hour, Kirk Heinze hosts and learns about new sustainability-related exhibits at MSU's Broad Museum. And he learns about an effort to make food labels more useful for consumers. And Kirk talks with MSU geography professor and the state of Michigan's climatologist, Jeff Andreessen.
The warming of the last century and a half just can't be explained by the atmospheric noise alone. And there's quite a bit to support that. At least some of it is we have to look at the greenhouse gas emissions. I think that's the only real explanation.
It's MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. We get started at 4:06. To Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's Kirk Heinze.
Well, back for a semi-annual visit to discuss climate-related developments and concerns is a good friend, Dr. Jeff Andreessen. Jeff is the state climatologist for Michigan and a professor in the MSU Department of Geography. Jeff, it's always good to catch up on climatological matters, especially this year with so much going on.
It's great to be back, and as usual, there's plenty to talk about.
Well, let's talk about, on this program in the past, we've talked about El Nino and La Nina. There's been a lot in the news. Explain to our listeners what these phenomena actually are.
Right. Well, El Nino is a nickname of a two-phase phenomenon, and it's a combined circulation pattern both in the atmosphere and in the oceans. And it's concentrated in the equatorial Pacific region of the world, and it's part of something larger called the El Nino Southern Oscillation, ENSO or ENSO for short. And El Nino is the warm or negative phase of ENSO, and then La Nina is the nickname for the cool or the positive phase. And the warm and cool refer to ocean or sea surface temperature anomalies that are either significantly below or above long-term normals. And we've just been through, depending on how it is defined, but it's certainly one of the strongest El Nino events of the last century here. It began last summer. It took it a while to get going, but once it did, it was a big event globally. And why it matters to us, something in the equatorial Pacific, many people always ask, well, that's thousands of miles away, and it's true. But the issue is that El Nino and La Nina, these two phases, are associated with very unusual, sometimes almost reversals of normal sea or ocean current patterns and atmospheric patterns as well. And ultimately, many of these patterns influence the pattern or flow of the jet stream around both hemispheres, both the north and south. And of course, for us here in the Midwest and in temperate areas around the world, the jet stream is the primary controlling factor for our day-to-day and week-to-week weather. So if there's something that influences that in the Pacific, it matters to us. And what we see typically, we find certain types of weather patterns that are associated with El Nino. It tends to, both of these things, El Nino and La Nina, tend to happen during the Northern Hemisphere winter and spring months. And not always, but most more often than not, they do. And when we do have El Ninos at this time of the year, typically our winters across the Midwest and much of the northern U.S. Tend to be milder than normal. And here and within the Great Lakes region, they also tend to be drier than normal, statistically. Not all of them, but more often than not. So that's why it's important. ENSO, or El Nino Southern Oscillation, turns out to be the most important tool in the long lead outlook prediction business that there is, and it hasn't been known about for that long, but it's a very, very important component of global climate. And again, it allows meteorologists and climatologists to look out beyond more than a few days or a few weeks. We can actually look out at months in advance. And in some parts of the world, notably the Pacific Rim and low latitude areas, it's highly, highly correlated with weather patterns there, and more strongly than it is here. But it's a huge, it's a global phenomenon, and that's why it gets so much publicity. It had the weather patterns with that lead to, well, droughts, famines, all sorts of problems, but also to positive weather anomalies as well. So it's a big deal, and it influences us here, even thousands of miles away.
Even though El Nino is fading, and some say, I think you said, stick a fork in it,
right.
And La Nina is emerging. But we did have a milder winter here in Michigan this year, and then we've got quite a bit of dryness. Those are typically associated with El Nino.
We did, but it's we had here in Michigan, that we look overall for the state collectively, our winter mean temperatures were 7.5 degrees Fahrenheit above normal. That's way up there. That's the fifth warmest winter on record. So certainly in that regard, it was very, very El Nino-like, the winter. However, more often than not, our winters are also dry, but ours, of course, was not. We had wetter than normal conditions during the winter, and also we had a warm and wet spring as well, although not to the same extent. So a reminder that not all of those events are the same, at least the impacts, but it has been unusually warm, and that certainly follows the vast majority of El Nino events are mild, and that was certainly the case now. But yes, to your last comment, it has left, even with the wetter than normal winter, because of dryness since early and middle May, we've turned the other direction really, really, really quickly.
My guest is Dr. Jeff Andreessen. We're talking El Nino and La Nina. He's the state climatologist for Michigan, professor in the MSU Department of Geography. Well, we're talking about weather in Michigan here, Jeff. You just talked a little bit about our spring. As we're moving into summer now and into the fall, what's the outlook in the Great Lakes region?
Well, I would love to say, at least as we're speaking, I'd love to say that it was one with more precipitation. We really are in need of water in many parts of the state. Not all, but more and more each day, because we have been trending drier than normal over roughly the last 4 to 6 weeks. And unfortunately, we're at a time of the year when the water needs, both for agricultural crops, but also for natural vegetation, are reaching their peaks seasonally. We need a lot of water at this time of the year, so that's not a favorable trend, and we've missed out on a lot of rainfall that's fallen in other parts of the region. So right now, parts of southern and eastern Michigan are among some of the driest parts of the Midwest. But that said, the outlook here for at least for the next few weeks suggests unfortunately, a little bit more of the same. Temperatures probably coming out a little bit above normal levels, and precip. We'd be lucky, I think, if we were hitting normal, but it probably, unfortunately, will remain below normal levels. Now, the long lead outlook for the remainder of the summer itself has been consistent in calling for warmer than normal mean temperatures. That's been in our forecast for a while. Precipitation-wise, though, there's no direction. There isn't a piece of the forecasting guidance that really says stay drier or that we'll turn wetter. Right now, it's considered officially equal odds of below, near, and above normal. That's also been the case now for a few months. So, and that's not so bad, but we have to remember that if it does indeed turn out to be warmer than normal, then the needs for water will be greater than they typically are. Warmer air holds more moisture, more water vapor, and so those crop water needs and vegetation water needs will be larger as well. So irrigation has already become important in this particular year, but hopefully we'll get some help from Mother Nature with some natural rainfall here soon.
Well, you anticipated with irrigation, but we had the wet spring and a fairly wet winter, so the groundwater reserves are probably okay right now.
That's right.
But the irrigation will draw those down.
And that's a very, very good point. We have come out of other winters that were much drier, and we'll use 2012 as an example of that, where we came out of a very, very mild winter, but it was also drier than normal, and the reserves in the soil, which may be, depends greatly on soil type, from as little as maybe 3 inches in the top 3 feet or so for a very sandy soil to as much as maybe 7 or 8 inches in a heavy clay-based soil. that are all available to plants. It's a very, very important part of how they operate during the warm season. We're relying on those reserves heavily right now. One of the problems, of course, is that plants or crops that were planted may not have the roots to take advantage. Mm-hmm. But you're right. There still is moisture
because
in the
root
ground.
Development hasn't occurred because of the lack
right.
of...
That's right. Or again, there's a number of issues with planting in the dry conditions like that. Yeah. But there is water there, and that hopefully will help for later on in the season if it does continue to be dry.
I'm talking with Dr. Jeff Andreessen, state climatologist for Michigan. I'd like to get into the something we always talk about this time of the year, our lake levels. Mm. How are they and in general, and what's the outlook as we move again into the summer and the fall?
Lake levels, as most people probably appreciate if you've been there, have changed dramatically, and that's an understatement over the last couple of years, but they're significantly above our long-term normals. But saying that, we don't have to go back too far, less than 2 years. In some cases, we were near record low levels. So the change that we have observed here, really since the winter of 2013-14, has been nothing short of incredible, almost record-breaking. It's been one of the most rapid increases in lake levels that we've seen historically.
In fact, some people are even beginning to worry. The same people who worried about whether they're ever going to get their boats back in the water are now concerned about whether the water's going to come up into their cottages.
I was just going to bring that up. It's amazing how things change if you give them time. But I've heard many comments from folks about, oh, we had so much beach just a year and a half ago, but now not so much. And it's part of the natural variability of our system. Most of the change that we've seen can be attributed to increased precip in the basin, of course, the supply of water into the lake system itself. The other part of it that most people don't think about, though, is we had two very severe winters in 2012-13 and 2013-14, in which there was a great deal of ice cover on the lakes, mm-hmm. and that ice inhibits, or in some cases prohibits, evaporation and loss of water. So there's a balance there. Both of those, though, combined with so much ice on the lakes with above normal precipitation, to really, really change things quickly. We had been, prior to that, back at the beginning of 2013, our lakes had been at below normal levels for several years,
right.
Unusually low levels, and in the case of Superior and Michigan, near record low levels. So we've just had an amazing turn or change in a short period of time.
One of the problems, as you well know, in Lake Erie is the depth of that, because and that helps. That's one of the factors that's conducive to those algal blooms that form in Lake Erie. Are those levels going up as well? Lake Erie is just by nature, in and of itself, shallower than the other lakes, right?
That's right. It behaves a little bit differently, especially in the winter. It's the first one to freeze over because of its depth, and again, it just behaves a little bit differently than a lake, say, like Superior, where you've got much more volume of water, and it's more complex, mm-hmm. What goes on there, the depth and so forth. So the biology and ecology is a bit different as well. But all the lakes, at least the upper lakes, have recovered pretty significantly since, especially though Superior and Michigan.
And, of course, this is a little bit aside that comment, but all the research that's being done in the Great Lakes and the Great Lakes restoration and the attention that the mayors and agriculture are paying to our crown jewel, really, is got to be good news to a climatologist, but it's got to be good news for society in general.
It is, and I think it's a reminder. It's one of the most valuable resources that we have. And unfortunately, it's like everything, there are limitations, and we have to remember that, and it has to be protected. And it's encouraging to see that there are rules and such in effect that do look at the long-term sustainable outcome that we all probably want and need.
Jeff, let's turn to a topic that's much more problematic, and that's carbon dioxide concentrations in the atmosphere. We're moving north. We're we're over 400 parts per million of carbon dioxide now. Climate patterns and carbon dioxide concentrations, is there a relationship?
There is. It's a very, very strong relationship. And we know over geologic time frames in Earth's history that when we have had high carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases as well, such as methane, when those concentrations in the atmosphere have been high, so have air temperatures at the same time. And where it starts to become a bit more complicated is what precedes what or what begets what. And we've seen both ways. But we know without question there's a very, very strong correlation between these the concentrations of these gases and our surface temperature. And the climate has varied dramatically. Of course, we in Michigan hear from tropical to glacial and everything in between, just as an example of that. But as you mentioned at the beginning, the rising concentrations now beyond 400 parts per million are a real concern and are very likely associated with some of the increase in temperature that's been observed globally here, certainly over the last 1 to 2 centuries. And basically past the or from the end of or beginning of the Industrial Revolution up to the present. Very, very rapid increase in emissions of these gases, but we also have warming, and there's been some news globally that I think is certainly important, and we have set a number of new all-time records for global temperature that are worth noting, and one of them is just, well, we've set an all-time new global high temperature for the warmest, and that's combined land and ocean temperatures on our record. That essentially goes back about a century and a half, but it's still noteworthy, and it's still an indicator that our global temperatures are continuing to increase and are going to reach new highs. A couple of the other ones, though, virtually all of the highest temperatures have occurred within the last 20 years, and some that are eye-openers. 13 of the greatest 15 monthly departures from normal on the positive side have all occurred in the last 15 months, including that highest temperature on record, which was set earlier this spring. And associated with that, of course, we have near record low levels of sea ice and rates of melting as well. Those are all correlated. One other one that's worth noting too, I think, is that it's not only our conventional observing network, which is thermometers or temperature sensing devices around the world. That's been our conventional one. There's also another set of data taken from satellite,
right,
that looks down on the Earth and basically can sample every square mile or foot, as it were, and very, very accurate. The problem, of course, is it's much shorter in duration. It only goes back to the 1970s. But this particular record, it measures temperatures in roughly the lowest 5 miles of the atmosphere. So it's not the same thing as what our conventional network does, but it's still looking at the lower part of the troposphere, the lowest major layer of the atmosphere. And it has risen over time, but it hasn't behaved quite like the surface series that I mentioned before. And that was listed as a concern in terms of what's going to happen or what's happening. That has recently also set all-time new records. So the comment was that this particular satellite record is not increasing. So there's something wrong here, something that's not adding up. That's no longer the case. That record is also showing.
That's becoming more consistent with the.
It is, and again, it isn't the same thing. That's the most important thing to note. But it also has recently reached new record levels. Now, that said, an important caveat is that some of this, the record high temperatures that we've observed here over the last year, are associated with El Nino. Remember, warmer than normal sea surface temperatures over thousands of miles of the equatorial Pacific. That's part of it. There also, interestingly, are record warm temperatures in much of the Indian Ocean basin at the same time. But collectively, much of the world, not all, but most of the world is at or near record warm values right now. But these oceans, which cover, of course, 70% of the globe, when they're that warm, the averages all show positive or all show large deviations from normal. And so El Nino's part of it, but it's still a longer-term trend.
For those who would suggest that this can all be attributed to normal or historic climate patterns as opposed to human activity, what would you say?
There's a growing research, lots of research to suggest that is not the case, that the warming of the last century and a half just can't be explained by the atmospheric noise alone. And there's quite a bit to support that. At least some of it is we have to look at the greenhouse gas emissions. I think that's the only real explanation.
Well, on that note, it's been a pleasure, as always, to talk with Dr. Jeff Andreessen, state climatologist from Michigan and professor in the MSU Department of Geography. Jeff, I hope we get some rain here the next few weeks. I know you do
you
as well. But
yeah.
Thanks so much for being a guest on Greening
the Great Lakes.
It's
my pleasure. Thank you.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Well, a few days ago, I had the pleasure of viewing two very moving exhibitions at the wonderful Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum on the campus of Michigan State University. One exhibition features images of courage and resolve in the face of environmental disaster, and the other, the tragedy and trauma suffered by refugees who are living in unimaginable conditions in remote Algeria. To discuss both, it is indeed a pleasure to welcome to the program Stephen L. Bridges. Stephen is assistant curator of the Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I mentioned this museum we have on the campus of Michigan State University that is indeed a jewel. Tell us a little bit about the background of the museum for our listeners who may not have heard about it.
Absolutely. So the Broad Art Museum was founded in 2012 here at MSU, and it kind of in a way kind of fulfilled a desire, I think, by its both its kind of founding supporters, in specifically in name the Eli and Edith Broad, as well as other constituencies around campus and in the local community, to have a venue for contemporary art, the most forward-thinking, kind of the most kind of challenging as well as exciting contemporary art in the world today. And then it dovetails very well with MSU's international kind of mission. So a lot of the work that we bring is from all across the world, definitely fulfills that international focus.
And there was quite a story on the structure itself.
Exactly, yeah. So they did an open call. They did an open bid for the architectural firm to build the museum. And we are blessed to work in a Zaha Hadid design building. She is
one of the great architects of the world.
Absolutely. One of one of the four forerunning, and unfortunately recently deceased. She's an international renowned architect, and her building is just, it's absolutely stunning. And I believe this is still true, it's the only freestanding designed building by Zaha Hadid in North America.
Wow. Wow. Quite a gem for sure. Let's go to the two exhibitions. Let's start with Gideon Mendel's Drowning World. It includes some digital prints, some video, even some newer works that he calls his watermarks. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. So Gideon Mendel is a photographer that was kind of came to be known for his work in South Africa around the AIDS crisis kind of in the 80s and 90s. And that's where he kind of made his name as kind of a photojournalist, kind of working in that vein, but has since moved out of that realm, although kind of keeping close to photojournalism, more into a contemporary art realm. But his portraits focus on individuals who have suffered from flood victims. So it's a very unique approach that he takes, but he essentially, whenever these natural disasters take place, he travels to those locations. Where most people are trying to get away from those locations, he goes directly to them and then works with individuals in those communities and actually goes into their home environments or domestic environments mostly and photographs them as they re-enter their homes for the first time. So these portraits of these individuals from all across the world, from India, Missouri, I think is one of the most
Bangladesh,
recent.
Bangladesh. Yeah.
excuse me, Bangladesh, Africa. He photographs them in the environments in their home, and oftentimes the water is still there. So, you know, the water is creeping up their bodies. It's still the remains of the watermarks are on the walls and things like that. You can see a glimpse of the devastation, but most importantly, you have a human face to these kind of disasters, right? Oftentimes they become portrayed in the media as these kind of spectacularized events. And we don't really understand the human impact on the ground, so to speak. And so what he's doing essentially is recovering that sense of humanity, that sense of empathy that we have, and that sense of belonging that we share with all the people. So,
yeah, and the sense I got, and everybody reacts to these exhibitions differently, but there wasn't a whole lot. It wasn't like these people, classic portraiture, but they weren't broken down. They weren't defeated. There was a sense of resolve and a sense of courage that comes through those portraits.
I like that. I'm glad that that's your reading. I think that's a really important reading, that there isn't just this devastation, broken, lost, that there is hope inside these eyes. And I think the portraits are so striking because a lot of times the individual being photographed is having a direct eye contact with the camera, and therefore kind of with you as the viewer of these images. And you can see in their eyes that there is this strength, this kind of unrelenting, kind of willful strength that remains in those individuals. And there is this sense of perseverance that I think comes through as well. Absolutely.
And then there's this whole business of watermarks, which we can all relate to. Water damage photos that he found in these homes that he actually finds some aesthetic value to.
Absolutely. So, of course, in the wake of these kinds of natural disasters, there's a lot of debris and other materials are kind of left, kind of scattered about. And what he does is he's kind of course, being a photographer, attracted to the photographs that he's found. And a lot of times, you know, they're family photo albums that have essentially been washed away. And so you have these collections of older photographs, you know, you remember Polaroids and Kodak, like old Kodak kind of images, 3x5s and things like that. And oftentimes they're kind of, you know, because they get wet and they have that film on them, they kind of get glued together. So you have to peel them apart after the damage. But what happens is that the water kind of shifts the colors in the images, right? They become a bit more abstract.
Right.
Strange things happen within the images as a result of their mixing with the water and other chemicals and other things that are in the water. And then what he does is he scans those and blows them up. So he's essentially taking these found objects, scanning them, and turning them into larger photographs. And they almost, in a way, become similar to paintings. They're so beautiful. Yeah. But there is, it's a strange thing, I guess, in a way, for me to call them beautiful, though they are. Knowing the kind of the backstory and the kind of more kind of the struggle that lies beneath their surfaces, in a sense.
My guest is Stephen Bridges. He's the assistant curator of the Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum at Michigan State University. The next exhibition you curated, it's called Sam Jury to Be Here, a very haunting and different kind of an exhibition about refugees who've been in refugee camps for a very long time.
That's correct, yes. So the artist, Sam Jury, is a British artist and filmmaker. She spent a two-week residency in a camp, a refugee camp in southwest Algeria called the Boujdour camp. And these settlements house Sahrawi refugees who originally were from Western Sahara and were displaced by the end of European colonialism in Africa and then ensuing roughly 20-year armed conflict with the Moroccan government. And so that situation politically is still unresolved at this time. And those communities have been displaced to those settlements. And so she spent 2 weeks there filming and recording and working.
Using handheld camera, right?
Exactly, yeah. Because of the conditions in the Sahara Desert, it's a very extreme environment. She can only bring certain lightweight, more kind of easily and readily kind of available materials to work with. So it lends to a much more kind of improvised, kind of almost first-person perspective within the videos that she created.
Despite the darkness and the sort of sense of hopelessness that I felt looking at those, she uses light, almost glimmers of light that are coming through windows or door cells that provide maybe a glimmer of optimism for the condition that these people are in.
Yeah, that's, again, I think you're reading that absolutely right. There's a strong sense of still hopefulness. I mean, there's this kind of melancholic quality to both of to all of the installation. But she's also, being a filmmaker and having a very cinematic kind of eye for filming, she is very interested in creating these vignettes, and as well as this history of art, of the importance of light as kind of being a symbolic of hope and kind of, I don't know, an awakening or something, or kind of revitalization or something of that sort.
What about the young girl, the narration that mm-hmm. is sort of a voiceover, some of these images? Also hard to determine or hard to glean a sense of hope from what that young girl is saying. How do you read that?
You know, I think what she expresses is a kind of underlying sense of frustration. And what is it being, what is developing there is that there are individuals such as the narrator, who's a bit younger, not entirely sure of her age, but she was born in the camp and she's lived her entire life in the camp. I mean, these camps have existed for almost 40 years now. So there's a certain generation of individuals that don't know, they don't even remember the homeland, so to speak. They don't know anything other than the camps. And what she's expressing is a bit of a frustration with this kind of stasis that they're in. There is no resolution. There's not much being done to kind of proactively address that. And so she's kind of explaining for herself that she wants more out of life, and she's kind of talking about the want and the desire that she has to do something different. So in that sense, I think it kind of bends that story towards that positive note, where that restlessness, rather than kind of eating away at them, is kind of, I think, for her and the younger generation, it's feeding into a desire for change, for doing something, to be proactive in their communities, to kind of force.
And the fact that even though she's never been outside that refugee camp her entire life, she's able to say, this doesn't mean that I've given up hope.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly.
Well, both of these exhibitions are wonderful. If you get a chance to get over to the Broad Art Museum, it's Sam Jury, To Be Here, Gideon Mendel, The Drowning World. It's been a pleasure talking with Stephen L. Bridges, Assistant Curator of the Eli and Edith Broad Art Museum. Stephen, love to have you back on as you do more of these sorts of exhibits that really look at sustainability across the spectrum of environment, social, and economic.
Absolutely, yeah. I would love to, and I look forward to it.
You're tuned to Greening of the Great Lakes inside MSU today on AM 870 WKAR. Here's more with Kirk Heinze.
Many of us who try and be at least somewhat health conscious have struggled mightily to comprehend nutrition labeling on food packages. Why, we might ask, does it have to be so complex? Why is the type so small? What exactly are we looking for? In short, can nutrition labeling be improved? Well, here to address that question are Dr. Laura Bix. Laura is an MSU professor of packaging, and Mark Becker. Mark is an MSU Associate Professor of Psychology, and they co-led a recent study to address a fundamental question: can nutrition labeling be improved, and if so, how? Laura and Mark, it's a pleasure to have you on the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
It's good to be here. Thanks.
Laura, let's start with you. Give us a little bit about the genesis of the research and some of your basic research questions. Did I capture it a little bit in my intro?
Oh, I think absolutely. What my lab does is we try to quantify the interface between people and packaging with an eye to improving health outcomes. And so certainly with the obesity epidemic, labeling and how can we make more effective labeling falls under that umbrella.
Well, you mentioned obesity. It's a pandemic issue. You know that, particularly in the United States. Is there a correlation between the understanding of labeling and obesity?
Well, certainly there are studies that suggest that labels are effective when they're used. One of the challenges that we have is how do we get people to engage with the labeling, which is primarily what Mark and I looked at.
Laura, you're a packaging expert, so it sort of fits that you'd be doing this kind of research. Mark, you're a psychologist, and at first glance, that might seem a bit of an anomaly. Why a psychologist and a packaging expert working together?
Well, in the area of psychology I'm in is cognitive psychology, and my specific expertise is understanding visual attention and the processes that guide the allocation of visual attention to different aspects of our environment. And so years ago, I got a call from Laura, who said, we should team up because I'm designing labels, but in order for those labels to be effective, we need people to be able to cognitively process their meaning. And so we started to apply cognitive models of information processing to the design of labels in an attempt to get a label that's designed for how people think.
Well, I'm reading a little bit about your research, and this research, I might mention, was funded in part by our good friends at MSU Ag Bio Research and the National Institutes of Health. But the methodology was very interesting. Would one of you like to talk a little bit about how you went about this study?
Well, I think the methods really come from the field, from Mark's field, cognitive psychology. And in the study that was highlighted recently, we used a change detection technique. Basically, what happens is a piece of a scene appears and disappears on a computer screen, and we look at how quickly do people find them and whether or not they find the disappearing part of the image before timing out.
Did you want to add? Sure. And I'll just add that type of change, I mean, you can kind of think of this as a game like spot what's different in this picture, but rather than being side by side, the two pictures alternate in time. And if you put a small break between those alternations, then the motion that normally captures your attention to a change gets swamped by that blank screen. And so what that allows us to do is now detecting that change requires people to be paying attention to that changing information. So we can actually track when people pay attention to different information using this method.
So I take it from these images are not necessarily labels or packaging labels. These could be any types of images that you're tracking. So what were some of the images that people were asked to track?
Well, so again, we borrowed the technique. So you're right that in basic research, people have used this technique to track attention in all sorts of images. But actually, in our work, we applied that to actual packages and package labels so we could see how people prioritized different aspects of the label for attention.
Okay, well then let's get to the findings because the listeners say, okay, so what did you discover? And you had at least three significant findings. Share those with our listeners.
So what we looked at specifically were front of pack labels. Front of pack labels are widely used throughout the world. What these labels are is they are pieces of the nutrition facts panel, which probably most of your listeners are familiar with. That's usually on the right side of the package, and it's very sort of I don't want to say complicated, but there are a lot of grams and percentages and things like that. What the front of pack does is it takes a few nutrients or ingredients that are relevant to disease states, like saturated fat, sugar, and sodium, and calories, and moves it to the front of the package. The idea is that this will be more prominent, more conspicuous to users, and facilitate the ability to cross-compare products. So that when you're standing in the freezer aisle, you can look at one type of ice cream bar versus another type of ice cream bar, and if you are diabetic or hypertensive, make a very quick decision.
The biggest finding right off the bat is that when we compared people's ability to detect changes that occurred to these front-of-pack labels that Laura was talking about versus a size-matched change in the traditional nutrition facts panel, people were way, way faster and more accurate at finding changes to the front-of-pack label, suggesting that that front-of-pack label is being attended much earlier during viewing the product than information in that nutrition facts panel. And in fact, for the experiment, since we ran it on a computer, we actually had to flatten the images so that you could see the front panel and that side panel where the nutrition facts panel is at the same time. So we were giving an advantage to that nutrition facts panel, the traditional nutrition facts panel, by doing so. And even so, the results were striking. So if we used a color front of pack label, and I should say a little bit about that, which is in the colored front of pack labels, not only are you pulling those key ingredients to the front, but you're actually giving some type of qualitative system for rating whether it's high, medium, or low. And we used a traffic light system where high, potentially negative health consequent related foods were presented with a little red stoplight, medium yellow and low green. When we use that label and had it be the target for the change detection, people were much more accurate. So about 90% accurate in finding the changes with that compared to when we had a size match control, it dropped to about 30% accuracy. So we got basically a tripling of ability to find these changes in the, I believe it was 20 seconds, is that right?
It was 10.
In the 10 seconds we gave people to find these changes.
Yeah, so they were more accurate and faster at finding changes to the front of the pack than the side. And as Mark mentioned, even when we flattened it out, giving that side an advantage that it normally wouldn't have because normally people would have to rotate it. So color was a huge effect. And color is kind of a contentious issue throughout the world. It has the arguments against doing this because it has been done in other parts of the world are that you run the risk of villainizing a product that doesn't deserve to be villainized. Like if you compare a diet soda to milk, for instance, will you end up unfairly disadvantaging a product that should be a healthier choice? Other arguments against the use of color include the idea of whose diet are you basing those color cutoffs on? Because if you're diabetic or if you're hypertensive, you know, certain nutrients may be very, very important to you to avoid. But if you're an athlete, they may be less of an issue. And so it is a contentious issue the world over. But our research, which concentrated on early stage sort of attention, how can we draw people in? Because again, if we can get people to use these labels, we know that they're more effective. So what we were looking at is when you're not specifically tasked with a nutrition sort of related task, can we draw you in? Can we engage you with the nutrition information?
My guests are Laura Bix, professor of packaging, and Mark Becker, associate professor of psychology at Michigan State University. We're talking about nutrition labeling. Mark, one of the surprising findings had to do with, and this is going to sound sort of mundane, but it really isn't, smiley faces on packaging versus colors.
Yeah, so when we first designed the experiment, one of the conditions, one of the treatments we tested was rather than just use color to indicate high and low health values, to use kind of little emotional icons of faces. So smiley faces for things that were low in, say, saturated fat, frowny faces if they were high in saturated fat. And we tested this based on a whole bunch of basic research coming out of my field that suggests that people really attentionally prioritize face stimuli. We're social animals. We pay attention to people. And we get a lot of information from looking at people's faces and reading people's facial emotions. And so we thought a really effective way to draw attention might be to include little face icons. Surprisingly to us, when we took that basic research out of the basic setting and put it on applied packaging, the effects went away. And really, color really drew attention, these face stimuli didn't, which is part of why you need to get out of the basic lab and try to apply some of these to more realistic contexts.
Yeah, it occurs to me on front of labeling, and this is a question as you've been talking about your findings, the front of package tends to also, that's been designed to draw readers, to consumer attention to the product with logos and other sorts of things. I mean, how much of that attention that was drawn to the front is a combination of factors, not only the current packaging on a particular product that's been designed to draw attention, plus the location. I mean, is there some combination going on there?
Well, yeah, our work actually found that it's a combination not only of the design factors in the front of the pack, but also the location as well. In the first experiment that we did, we made our own packages. We called them kind of vanilla package. So we didn't have any spokes characters. We didn't have any celebrity people. They were very sort of plain Jane type of packages. Additionally, the changes that were flashing in and out of the image on the nutrition facts panel were pieces of the nutrition facts panel that were sized to be equivalent to the front of pack. In a second experiment, a follow-up experiment, we used actual branded product, so much sort of higher marketing-driven sort of principal display panels or fronts of packs. And then we also used color changes in the nutrition facts panel because we wanted to give it sort of the design benefits that the front of pack had. We still found significant differences in the probability of finding a change prior to timing out and the time to find a change, although the differences were diminished significantly. So certainly your point of what surrounds it makes a difference was there, but we still did find a benefit.
So you're controlled for that particular type of marketing strategy on those packages. It also occurs to me, listeners might be wondering, okay, this research is very interesting. It's good for consumers. And this is, I'm going to ask you to go 30,000 feet here. How interested are food companies really in doing this sort of thing? How interested are food companies in having people read packaging labels?
Well, I think food companies, you know, they don't want to have things not be good for you. They want to sell you products. And so there's a couple maybe unintended consequences that could happen if the FDA were to move toward this type of system. One is I think we'd probably see a lot of reformulation happening. The benefits might not be limited to just engaging the users or the consumers better, but also in some reformulation going on with the manufacturers. There are also some standardized systems for front of packs that the grocery manufacturers and some of the food associations have come together and created voluntary standards. Those standards don't use color for a lot of the reasons that I mentioned before, but you will see an increasing amount of front of pack labels, even though they're not being regulated at present, I think.
I want to thank MSU Professor of Packaging Laura Bix and MSU Associate Professor of Psychology Mark Becker for being on the program.
That was Dr. Kirk Heinze with a sustainability-focused Greening of the Great Lakes segment inside MSU Today here on AM 870 WKAR. To read Kirk's blog and hear more Greening of the Great Lakes content, visit mlive.com/environment.
I'm Scott Westerman from the Michigan State University Alumni Association with another observation from The Spartan Life. The ability to simplify means to eliminate the unnecessary so that the necessary may speak. Hans Hoffman. One of the things you will discover as you become successful is this. The more you do, the more people will ask you to do. Exceed your targets at work and there will be new, higher targets. Do a great job on one board and people will want you on a dozen boards. Kaizen, the Japanese word for continuous improvement, is something toward which we should all strive. But be sure you understand your own personal definition of improvement. It doesn't necessarily mean doing more. If you've had a business course, you likely know the name Peter Drucker. As the father of modern management, Drucker gave us a number of good maxims, including the concept of the knowledge worker. What is not well known is that his advice for personal growth includes practicing systematic abandonment. He wrote that people are effective because they say no, because they say, this isn't for me.
and he advocated regular reflection on what you can cut out of your daily routine to make room for something more rewarding. I used to start every budget season by telling my team the time we invest in the new year will be just as important as the money we invest. Our success may well be determined by what we decide we're not going to do. When was the last time you took out a pad of paper or your iPad and listed everything that takes up your time? Try keeping an activity log for 30 days and you'll be surprised how much unproductive, unfulfilling things pop up on that list. Then go back to that bucket list you've been keeping. You know, the things you've always wanted to do but never had the time to do. Start crossing things off your activity list that are sucking energy or aren't generating enough joy and enthusiasm for you. Replace them with things that are on your bucket list. This won't be an easy exercise. Most self-actualized people overbook themselves with many things that are worthwhile and rewarding. You may decide that you will want to stop doing something you enjoy to do something you enjoy more. Sometimes stopping an activity will cause discomfort for people you care about. As you prepare for that tough conversation, remember Herb Swope's advice. I cannot give you the formula for success, he says, but I can give you the formula for failure, which is try to please everybody. High-performance people see the world as a huge orchard with hundreds of ripe apples falling off of every tree. They stand at the edge with a small basket made up of time and energy and want to try to grab every last apple to make the most out of every opportunity. Some people are even paralyzed by the fear that they might pick the wrong apple and regret it. They are afraid that if they invest time in a new career path, the self-development course, or a new relationship, and end up not liking it, they will regret their decision. Rather than taking any chance, they do nothing. Your assignment? Live a life of ongoing self-discovery. As Drucker says, what matters is that the knowledge worker, by the time he or she reaches middle age, has developed and nourished a human being rather than a tax accountant or a hydraulic engineer. Realize that you don't have to do it all, that you can start down a road and decide to take a different road later on. Life is really that abundant apple orchard, but you don't have to eat every last one. Nourish the exceptional human being that you are, and remember that in the end, the only one you really have to make happy is you.
I'm Scott Westerman from the MSU Alumni Association. Learn more about Spartans Helping Spartans at alumni.msu.edu.
Thank you for listening to MSU Today on AM 870 WKAR. To hear this show again, click on the radio tab at WKAR.org and scroll to MSU Today every Sunday afternoon at 4 o'clock on AM 870 WKAR.